Welcome to next lecture on classical Hamiltonian mechanics. And so let me review what this Hamiltonian mechanics actually is in this geometrical picture. And so yesterday I introduced some notions and some definitions, so let me review some of them. So you start, of course, with the configuration space. And if you want to, let's call it C, and if you want to describe a motion of a system with n degrees of freedom, then this configuration space will be n-dimensional manifold. So let me plot it like this. So I can have a hole as usual in my manifold, and the motion is simply a curve which goes from a position at time equal to t0 to some later time. And this is my trajectory, which I can add, which is a curve on that manifold, and I call that trajectory delta. And so this is my configuration space. And of course, every point on the trajectory corresponds to the actual configuration of my system at a given time, and it describes the photo of the system. Okay. So then you have the notion of the phase space. And you define the phase space. So you really want to capture dynamics in the phase space. So it's not enough to actually speak about coordinates, but you also need to speak about momenta. And so you define this to be a cotangent bundle over my configuration space. And so because this is a cotangent bundle, it actually has a very nice structure. In particular, you can define a symplectic structure. So has a natural symplectic structure. Oh my god. So really you are using the fact that the phase space is very, very special space, which is a cotangent bundle, and then you have this symplectic structure omega living on it. And of course, you can choose special coordinates. So can choose, which we called yesterday Darboux coordinates. So that your symplectic structure takes a canonical form, dpi dqi, where these qi are coordinates on my configuration space, and qi and pi are local coordinates on my phase space, so it's my local coordinates. And in these coordinates, your omega takes this very special form. Okay, so it's, you know, just choosing the coordinates on this manifold and extend them to the cotangent space, and then this is what it is. Okay, so now, of course, the dynamics is captured, or if you want to prescribe dynamics, this is given by the Hamiltonian. Which is a function going from my phase space to real numbers. And so once you prescribe this Hamiltonian, once you prescribe this function on your phase space, then this gives a dynamical vector field. And this gives dynamical vector field. Which is just a Hamiltonian vector field prescribed to this function h. And so you have either omega dh, or the same thing, you take a Poisson bracket, you leave the first slot empty, and you feed a Hamiltonian to the second spot of your Poisson bracket. So now this omega is an inverse to that omega matrix inverse to that omega. And because small omega is non-degenerate, big omega is well defined. Okay, so this is a dynamical vector field XH. And of course, this vector field, well, lives on the phase space if you want, or on a tangent bundle of that phase space. And it defines the curves, in its integral curves on the phase space. So it gives dynamical vector field with integral curves or integral curve. And so I parameterized this curve again by t, which is just a parameter. And it's given by qit and pit. And you can find this curve by basically solving the Hamilton's equations. So this curve is given by Hamilton's equations. And so this is your vector field. So now you define this to be a time derivative. Well, this is just a definition, so okay. But what it actually is this guy is a tangent vector to my curve gamma. So any tangent vector is simply written as this, dqi over dt, and then the basis, and then plus dpi over dt, and the corresponding basis, dpi. Okay, so that's what a tangent curve is. Well, tangent vector to my curve gamma. But at the same time, you know that this is equal to the Poisson bracket, this thing here. And if you use the canonical Poisson brackets, so because we are using canonical coordinates, so this is just dH over dpi, d over dqi, minus dh over dqi, d over dpi. Okay, and then comparing the two expressions, I just arrive at my Hamilton's equations. So this is equal to that. So qi dot is dh over dpi, and this is equal to that. So pi dot is minus dh over dqi. And so you recognize this as Hamilton's equations. Okay. So this is all very nice, but after all, okay, so this is basically a solution for your integral curve gamma. But what you are in some sense really interested is just the trajectory, how delta t looks like, right? So you are interested where the particle is at a given time. And if that is all you are interested in, then you can just take your curve gamma t and project it down to the manifold. Okay, so to find trajectory, if that is all you are interested in, then use projection. And you know, so this is what I discussed last week. There's this canonical projection, which basically always projects from a cotangent bundle to the manifold, or from a tangent bundle to the manifold, but basically, you know, throwing away the components of the vector or of the form and keeping only where on the manifold you are, right? So it only keeps that point P. And so use projection on gamma T, and it's simply given by, this is just the projection, phi acting on gamma T. And so if this is your trajectory given by that. So now I have this simple example to illustrate this machinery, but it's very intuitively clear and very nice picture, right? So let's say I have an example of mathematical pendulum. So it's a system with 1 degree of freedom, which is the angle phi where you are. But the phase space, of course, is two-dimensional. So you have p of phi and phi. And so now if you are close to the origin, then it looks like a circle, basically. So this is, and then if you are farther away, actually what may happen, well, then the nonlinearity of the motion actually sort of comes in, approximating sine with theta, sine of theta with theta. So if you are very, very far for big theta, it's not really a circle, but it's more like an ellipse. And then what can happen with the swing is that if you swing it really, really fast, it can go around, right? And so going around means that actually you can go like that. So then you are actually moving around, the phi is increasing. So this is my phase space portrait. Of course, what I'm plotting here, these things, are precisely my curves, my integral curves, gamma t, which tell me, you know, well, at this point, I have that p and that phi. Okay, so now these are integral curves of my vector field x. So vector field x is in some sense a tangent vector to my integral curve gamma everywhere. Okay, so this would be my vector field x. And if you are interested in the trajectory, so this is the curve, the integral curve of that x in the phase space. But if you are only interested in the trajectory, then you basically forget about p, and you are only interested in phi. So then you canonically project whatever happens with gamma. So for example, here I just forget the p phi, and I just, for this circle, I just make a projection down here. And so this will be my delta t. And so whenever, you know, let's say I move this way or that way, doesn't matter. So that's this way here. Then you would be just swiping the trajectory of the angle over here. And that's what your delta. So this would, the phi actually is now your configuration space. And so this is the picture you have in mind. Questions? So isn't that beautiful? It's Hamiltonian mechanics, and it's done. Okay. So now let me just make two remarks. One of them will be very confusing, so let's not spend much time on it. So one remark is that, well, somebody already asked this question. So when you talk about Legendre transformation, you are doing something fishy and weird. And so what actually happens is that you are changing L to be Hamiltonian or vice versa. But of course, these are different spaces where these things live. So whereas the Hamiltonian is a function on, well, this is a function on T star of C, so on my cotangent bundle, Lagrangian, on the other hand, likes velocities instead of momenta. So it actually lives in the tangent space. So this guy lives in TC. So the Legendre transformation, what it actually does is maps what happens on the tangent bundle to what happens on the cotangent bundle. And this precisely corresponds to changing the velocities into the corresponding momenta. Okay, and everybody knows the prescription, so that's what you learn first thing when you do Hamiltonian mechanics. And so this is how I define my new momentum. And similarly, you can go the other way around by saying that Qi dot is the Hamiltonian, the Pi, and that Hamiltonian is just Pi Qi dot minus the Lagrangian. That's the prescription. Okay, so you can do that because you are given this function. So the function here maps, the tangent space to real numbers. And so you can use this function to define these things here, basically mapping between tangent space and cotangent space. So I have this stupid picture here. So you have tangent space here. This is related by Legendre transformation. Transformation to a cotangent space. So if you have a point in the cotangent space, then it's given by Qi and Pi. If you have a point in the tangent space, then it's given by Qi and Qi dot. Okay. And then the Lagrangian goes from here to a real number. And the Hamiltonian goes from here to real number as well. And then if you want, is this canonical projection pi, it will just give me the configuration space. And then if you have a point in the configuration space, it's just given by the coordinates Qi. Okay, so this is the picture how to think about Legendre transformation. So really the key idea is to realize that the objects live in different spaces. And so it maps one space to another space.
Yeah, I guess that makes me realize, you know, for free particle, for example, like we get that canonical momentum is just m times x dot.
Yeah.
But so the two sides of that equation live on different spaces then? Should we think of mass as some sort of math then?
In some sense, yeah, this is a definition. So what you would define really, so you would define, let's say I have this function L, and it depends on Q and Q dot. So then what you are really doing by going from one space to another space, you define momenta to be precisely this, dl over dqi dot dqi or something like this. And so this is now a one form and lives in a cotangent space. So yes, in some sense, they live in a different space. And yeah, but this is a definite. So you can exploit, so given the function L or any function F, you can always do this. So given a function F, which goes from T of C to R, you can write this. Mm-hmm. And once you write this, you sort of know how to transform one space to another space.
Okay.
They live in different space. Okay, so that was first remark. And then the second remark is obvious. So the way we define all this is we know that X of H is a Hamiltonian vector field. Which means it's defined over there as this omega dot dh or the Poisson bracket of something with H. But I showed you last time that any Hamiltonian vector field preserves the symplectic structure. Okay, so that means that L x of h omega equals to 0, because it's a Hamiltonian vector field, and that was a theorem yesterday. And of course, what it means is that from here you can show that Liouville theorem in Hamiltonian mechanics. Okay, so. It's just specifying the Liouville theorem for our case of Hamiltonian mechanics. Questions? Well, these are the two stupid remarks I wanted to make. So now, more funny part is the canonical transformations. again, if you want a definition, so we'll call a transformation qj qi pi, again no t, and then pj qi and pi, a canonical transformation is, well, this is a definition, is canonical if it preserves, canonical form of omega. Form of omega, meaning that in one set of coordinates, I write omega as dpi wedge dqi, and in the other set of coordinates, I write it exactly the same way, dpi wedge dqi. Okay, so you call such a transformation a canonical transformation. So now, so the condition it gives you is that it's n equal to 1 example. So in that case, you have omega, which is dp wedge dq. So now I write p as a function of small p and q, and q as a small function of small q. Okay, so this is dp over dq dq plus dp over small dp dp, and then wedge, and then dq, the same thing. dq, dq, dq plus dq, dp, dp. Okay, so now you just use the wedge product in between the two things. So of course, if I wedge product this guy with that guy, I get 0. So this is equal to 0 plus, and then I'll have dp over dq, and then dq over dp, and then dq wedge dp is this plus that. And then I take that with that, so it's plus dp over dp dq over dq dp wedge dq. And finally, this guy with that guy gives me 0. So, okay. So now I can flip these two by picking a minus sign. And so what you observe is that this is nothing else than Q and P. Q and P, the standard Poisson bracket, dp wedge dq. Okay? So now if you require that the transformation is canonical, it means that this guy has to be equal to 1, and it's precisely the condition for the transformation to be canonical. Okay, so this is all very nice. Of course, you can generalize this to n equal to n, not n equal to 1. Okay? So, yeah?
Can you remind me of the definition of big omega?
Of big omega, yeah. It's just a matrix inverse. So if you basically define omega by this thing here, delta alpha gamma. So, or in matrix notation, omega omega equals to 1. So yeah, you define it this way. But of course, this omega, you know, lives again. Well, it has indices up, so it lives in a different space, if you want. Both of them are anti-symmetric, so if you switch beta and gamma, or alpha and beta, you pick up a minus sign.
So then what can you also write down the expression for xh in terms of, okay, didn't we have something, like another expression?
Yes, 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 you can. So you can also write xh to be small omega, and now I don't know which one, but let's say, well, what was it? So now I need a vector field corresponding to H, and then you put a slot here. So now this will be a one form. This is a one form. So I need to raise the index. How does it work? Well, what is definitely true is this thing. XH hook omega is DH and probably this minus sign. So this is also, you know, you can solve this equation sort of uniquely. So you calculate what this guy is, and then you know what omega is, so you can find XH from here.
Yeah. So in this definition of canonical transformation, why is there no mention of the new canonical?
Why there is no mention of?
Like before that we did that, we had to say that, oh, it works for
Very good. Can you wait with that question till tomorrow, probably? Yeah, it's a very good question. Okay, so it will be answered tomorrow. Maybe today, but I doubt that. Okay, so now what happens if you having two Cartan's forms? So remember that we constructed omega from a Cartan form. So we have in one coordinates, you have theta, pi, dqi, and you define omega to be d of that theta. But in other coordinates, I can have a different Cartan form, which is now given by pi and then dqi. But it has to give me the same Cartan form and the same symplectic structure, because the symplectic structure simply doesn't care. It's still the same symplectic structure over there. Okay, so if you subtract the two things, so what it means is that d of, and now which one, which theta minus theta prime, well, it's omega minus omega must be equal to zero. Okay. But what that means is that this thing is locally written as d of something. Let's call it d of f. So then you are finding that theta minus theta tilde is d of some function. And of course, this function f is called generating function. Of my canonical transformation. And so, now this function f, of course, is a function of small q and p. But what happens is that you can choose other coordinates to be independent coordinates in your neighborhood. So for example, you can write p as a function of q and q if this is if these are sort of independent coordinates in that neighborhood. Okay, so in that case, I will have basically f as a function of q and q. And this is a special case when this actually is true, that these coordinates are independent in my neighborhood. Okay, so then we are getting an equation that pi dqi minus capital pi dqi is equal to df. But df is just df over dqi, dqi, plus df over d capital qi, dqi. Okay, well, very good. So now let's compare what we see on the left-hand side with what we see on the right-hand side. So this thing must be that. So we are getting a condition that small pi is df over the qi, and this thing, okay, so this is equal to that, and this is equal to that. So big pi is minus df over the qi. And these are precisely the conditions for your transformation to be canonical. So this is what we derived before. Again, no mentioning of Hamiltonian. It will be apparent tomorrow what happens with the Hamiltonian. Questions? So this is all you need to know about canonical transformations. So now this is the most beautiful thing. And that's the symmetries. Why don't I write first thing here, and then I write theorem as a separate thing. So let's discuss symmetries in Hamiltonian mechanics. And so I'll just write this, which will be useful for the proof of Noether's theorem, but it's all obvious identities. So by definition, this is df omega dg. But at the same time, well, this guy is just x, well, the vector field generated by g. So this is df dot xg. But of course, this is nothing else than xg acting on f, which is how the function f changes under this vector field x. And you can define this to be a time derivative of function f with respect to some time generated by the flow, generated by the function g. Okay, still doesn't work. Okay. At the same time, you can swap the order, because Poisson brackets are anti-symmetric. And then this must be minus L x of f acting on g, or it's minus dg over d time generated by function f. OK, obvious identities. If something here is not obvious, just think about it. But it all comes from all these definitions. And you know, knowing what the lead derivative is and knowing what the other things are and so on. OK. And we already used this thing previously, so it should be obvious. So now let me formulate Noether's theorem version 4, which is the Hamiltonian version, which is probably a very beautiful version. Noether's theorem. Version 4, which is the Hamiltonian version. Okay. And so it basically says, well, if I can find a vector field on my phase space, let's call it Y, such that two conditions are satisfied. First of all, this vector field doesn't do anything to my symplectic form, so it preserves the symplectic form, such that L of y omega equals to 0, and at the same time preserves my dynamics. And L of y acting on the Hamiltonian is equal to 0, so really it leaves not only the Hamiltonian untouched, but also my symplectic form. Then the statement is there exists a function I such that di over dt. What I mean by that is really this is equal to 0. And so whenever you have a symmetry, you know, you have a symmetry in the system, then there is a corresponding integral of motion, which is preserved along the motion. Okay? Proof is very simple. It's two lines. Now, so remember how we how we suffered for the proof of Noether's theorem, you know, in Lagrangian formulation, in the old formulation, and it was horrible, horrible mess. So now the proof here is really two lines. So the first line saying, well, you know that this is true. So that's your assumption. So now you use Cartan's lemma. So this is y hook d omega plus d y hook omega. Okay. So now this is zero by definition of omega. And so this guy must be equal to zero. Again, what it means is that this guy has to be locally written as d of something, and let's put a minus sign, and that something, let's call it I. So from this thing, we know then that there exists such I, so that the vector field y is actually a Hamiltonian vector field corresponding to this quantity. Or what it means is that y is the Hamiltonian vector field, at least locally. Okay, so that's the first assumption used. So now the second assumption, well, the second assumption is that Ly acting on my Hamiltonian is equal to zero, but we just proved that this is Hamiltonian vector field acting on H. So now if you look here and here, this is nothing else than a Poisson bracket of H and I, which is antisymmetric. But what this means is precisely written here. So it's minus di over dt. And you know that this is equal to zero. So you just shown that whatever this I function is, it actually is a conserved quantity. Isn't this beautiful? Okay, Noether's theorem. Now, it's interesting that people are still proving Noether's theorem. So although this was proved by Noether 100 years ago, in full generality, people still rediscover special cases of this and still write papers about it. So, but anyway, so this is a proof of a general theorem. So now, so what is very interesting here is that y is really a vector field on the phase space, right? So it's not necessarily a vector field on a configuration space. So y doesn't describe a symmetry of the configuration space, not necessarily. It is just a symmetry of the phase space. And it may happen that actually if you project this y into the configuration space, you don't get anything. So it may happen that the symmetry is not seen in the configuration space, okay? Which is something people don't realize. So whenever you know people discuss Noether's theorem, they say, well, I observe some symmetry of my configuration space, and then I have conserved quantity. But actually, it's not true. You may not have any symmetry in the configuration space, and still you may have actually a conserved charge, and you may have symmetry in the phase space. So let me stress this. So note that y is a symmetry of the phase space. Okay. And so you may have basically two possibilities. So now if you project this y, so this projection, well, okay. So the projection, I am using the same letter pi. So pi was a projection from, let's say, tangent space to my manifold, but you can also project the vector fields or tensor fields. So pi star is now projecting a tangent space of my phase space to two tangent space of my configuration space. So now this thing, let's call it y, and then you have two possibilities. Either y is actually equal to 0, or it's not equal to 0. Okay? So if it's not equal to 0, then there is some non-trivial vector field which is seen on this tangent space of the configuration space. And the corresponding transformations are called point transformations. Transformation. And on the configuration space, they are non-trivial. So you can really find, I have to rotate my configuration space and I get a symmetry. And so this corresponds to isometries and the standard thing which you know from your basic course on classical mechanics. On the other hand, if this guy is 0, then actually you don't see the transformation which makes a symmetry in the configuration space, so not visible on C. And because it's not visible, people call the corresponding symmetry hidden symmetry or a dynamical symmetry. So this is called dynamical or hidden symmetry. And so this is the case which people usually don't know about, that there is this possibility that really, if I project down to my configuration space, I don't see anything. But there is still a symmetry in the phase space. OK? So let me give you an example of this hidden symmetry. And actually, surprisingly, this hidden symmetry basically exists for any interesting, physically interesting systems. So it's actually curious that people don't know about it usually. And there is an extra symmetry to your classical systems. And so one of these systems is the Kepler motion. So let's do an example. And that will be that of a Kepler motion. And you will provide some details in tomorrow's tutorial on this, but let me just put some general facts. So of course, Kepler motion is just a motion in the central force, which however has a very special form. It's given by some constant over r square. And r hat, so it's always, it's a central force, and the magnitude is 1 over r square. Okay, and so this is spherical coordinates. So now what people know is that, well, they observe some symmetries of the configuration space. So everything is spherically symmetric, everything is static. So you have the following isometries. We have the following isometries. So you have, because the configuration is static, that means you have energy. Because it is spherically symmetric, you have what? What is conserved? You have angular momentum, which is conserved.
You mean which is static?
Oh, well, this force doesn't depend on time. The Lagrangian will not depend on time. Yeah. OK. And so people think, well, this is all the conserved quantities we have for Kepler motion. But it's actually not true. There is an additional motion. There is an additional hidden symmetry. So there is a hidden symmetry, which was discovered by Laplace and other people, and then rediscovered many times. Even Feynman actually pretends to discover it in one of his lectures, Probably he did. He was so genius that he did. So anyway, so you have an extra vector, which A, which is P times L minus M is the mass of the particle, the same K, and R hat. And so the statement is that you have three more conserved quantities here, and this is called Laplace Runge-Lenz vector. And so equally to L, which is conserved, this guy actually is conserved. So the geometrical meaning of this is very nice. So if you think about your ellipse, and so you have two foci, and so I make, this is my radius. Okay, so this is P times L, is that vector here. And then this is NK R hat, is that vector here. And you see that A is the difference between the two vectors. So there's a quantity which goes like here, A. Of course, you don't have to plot it in that point. You can plot it in this point here as well. And so then you have P times L is this vector. MK R hat is that vector. And this thing is A. And similarly here, so this will be my A vector, and this will be my vector A. So you have something which, no matter where on your trajectory you are, of course you are going faster here, you are going slower here, as you move on the ellipse, the vector A, which always points that direction and has the same magnitude, is conserved. Okay, so it's an extra symmetry in your of the motion. Okay, and so I think Feynman discovers it by some geometrical arguments in his lecture. I don't know if you've seen that lecture. I think the same thing probably did Laplace. So rediscovered many times. So now what is actually, well, okay. So a few facts. So, well, okay. What is interesting is that this is really a hidden symmetry. So if you know, there is no corresponding transformation you can do to your system on the configuration space so that actually you would see that this vector is conserved. There's no such transformation. In other words, for example, we discovered the symmetries as if you had a cyclic coordinate, which means that the Lagrangian didn't depend on some coordinate, and then you found the corresponding conserved quantity. So the statement is, no matter which coordinates I use, there is no corresponding cyclic coordinate to this quantity. So this is truly a hidden symmetry. The way how you can actually discover it is that you separate variables in your Hamilton-Jacobi equation in some weird coordinates. So that's one way how you can discover presence of A. But what actually people also discovered is that if you consider, you can map this problem, so for symmetry. So if you consider a problem of a motion of a free particle on a three sphere, then that problem can be exactly mapped to a Kepler problem. So Kepler problem is a two-dimensional motion, if you want. So now you go one dimensional higher, and you consider free motion of a particle. And that motion can actually be mapped to this motion. So there is a hidden SO4 symmetry, which corresponds to this. And you can read about this in Wikipedia. Okay. So free particle motion on three sphere is exactly equivalent to Kepler problem. Okay, but of course it doesn't explain anything. It doesn't explain why really you have this extra symmetry for Kepler motion. So now one more fact: you can find that A dot L is 0, and that a square is given in terms of what you already know, m square k square plus 2m el square. So these are two facts. So now if you consider the set of your integrals of motion, so you have e, l, and a, so it seems that you have one of those, three of those, and three of those. So it seems like you have seven quantities which are functionally independent. Well, that would be way too many because you have only 3 degrees of freedom. At most, you can have 5. But because of these two constraints, actually you have 7 minus 2 constraints, which is 5 functionally independent integrals of motion. And that means that your motion is maximally superintegrable. It's the nicest motion you can think about integrable. It's the nicest motion you can think about ever in classical mechanics. So you have 2n. So what we did is that if you have n degrees of freedom, I claim that if you have n functionally independent integrals of motion, then the motion is integrable. If these integrals of motion are special, meaning their Poisson bracket all vanish mutually. So now, if you have n plus 1, 2, 3, and so on, then you say the motion is superintegrable. Superintegrable. And if you have 2n minus 1, then it's maximally superintegrable. OK, it's just a classification. So Kepler problem is the nicest problem you can think about. And it has this hidden symmetry, and nobody knows why. And you know, it's exactly the thing which happens in physics, right? So in some sense, the physically interesting case is really, really special and really, really nice from a mathematical point of view. Nobody knows why. So if you consider motion in, let's say, normal spherically symmetric potential, which, however, doesn't have this Newtonian form, then the hidden symmetry actually disappears. So it's really distinguished. This special case of Newton is distinguished from anything else, or Coulomb, if you want. Questions? Huh. OK. And you will study this a little bit more tomorrow. You will really show that A, you know, when projected well, if you find the corresponding vector field which generates A, then if you project it down to your configuration space, you don't see anything. So you will see, you will really show that this is a hidden symmetry. All right, so I have some time to tell you about. So now let's leave grounds of Hamiltonian mechanics, and let's see how really general the Hamiltonian mechanics is. Can you do something which goes beyond Hamiltonian mechanics? And there's this beautiful example which goes back to 70s, and it's called Nambu mechanics. And although this hasn't proven to be really useful, at least not so far, and I think the applications actually are waiting for you to discover, although this has been here for more than 40 years, then I think it's an interesting example of what you can do, I know, where you can go beyond Hamiltonian mechanics. And so Nambu mechanics is, I think, 1973, formulated by Nambu. And so just to motivate, so you know that in Hamiltonian mechanics, it's basically given by specifying what a Hamiltonian is. So specify one Hamiltonian H. And everything is built based on the Poisson bracket F of G, which we know is omega X F X G. the corresponding vector flow is probably this minus sign, doesn't matter. But what is important is that this thing is a binary operation. Binary operation. And that, of course, is connected to the fact that omega is a two form. Okay, so that's what Hamiltonian mechanics is about. And then, of course, you are imposing some properties on omega, and that gives you what are the properties of the Poisson bracket. And then you define your time evolution as df over dt is f of h. Okay, so that's the review. Well, that's what Hamiltonian mechanics is. And I just remind you that this omega has to satisfy for consistency, basically d omega equals to zero, and that gives you the Jacobi identity and stuff like that for the Poisson bracket. Okay. So now, what number mechanics is? So what number asks is basically two questions. So one of them is, of course, all this works only if your phase space is 2n-dimensional. So if it is a symplectic manifold. Okay, so this works very nicely if it's 2n-dimensional space. But the question is, you know, why do you need 2n-dimensional space? Maybe you can go to some other space. So why 2n-dimensional phase space? That's the question. So cannot it happen that, let's say, I need to provide not only positions and momenta, but maybe I need to describe my system by some additional hidden variable, let's say ri, and then I goes from 1 to n. So maybe I need to describe my system not only by positions and momenta, but maybe I need something else. Okay, so let's allow for this possibility. And of course, another question is, well, here the dynamics is specified by one Hamiltonian. Right? So you just specify one Hamiltonian function, and that gives you, you know, how the system evolves. But why the hell one function is enough? Maybe it is the case that I need two functions or three functions. Why to limit to one function? Right? So why one Hamiltonian enough? Hamiltonian. So maybe do I need to, for example, a vector of my Hamiltonians to describe the dynamics? Okay, so these are, you know, just two questions he asked. And so how he resolved this, so what he did, he postulated instead of existence of omega of my symplectic two form, he postulated an existence of a tensor, which is now called Nambu tensor. Let's call it eta, like a Nambu tensor. So we didn't call it probably Nambu tensor, but now it's called Nambu tensor. And so to have nice properties, so you don't want any tensor, but why not a form? So let's call it so this would be a P form instead of a two form. And it has to satisfy for consistency some kind of d omega equals to zero. But now it's not enough to do just exterior derivative on eta equal to zero. That wouldn't work. So you need to do some more complicated derivative on eta and that equals to zero. And then you have nice properties. Okay. So let's do this. So then you can define. Okay, so once you have that form, can define Poisson bracket. Poisson bracket is just by now because it's a P form, yeah?
What is that big P?
I'm not telling you. Find it in Nambu's paper. It's something which satisfies some horrible conditions. It's not exterior derivative. It's not covariant derivative. It's some kind of weird derivative so that you get nice properties. Something like Jacobi identity, for example. But I'm not telling you. I'm not writing it down explicitly. Read it in Nambu's paper. Okay? So now you feed your P form p functions, right? So your Poisson bracket is now not a binary operation, but you need p things. And of course, this is defined as, well, OK, let me call it eta, and then x of f1, x of fp. Okay.
A small question, do we only have the r as extra hidden variable, or are the two p, r, diff, p, there are there p such things? Is p the best
No. Okay, so here, you know, so I'm just saying maybe it's not enough to specify the position and the momentum, but maybe I need some extra variable to describe my motion.
Yeah.
So let's call that extra variable r. Okay? And so this allows, maybe I just need one, maybe I need many, so maybe I just wrote it stupidly. So maybe you need qi, pi, and then some number of r variables, which are extra variables.
Mm-hmm.
But as a result, you don't have 2n-dimensional phase space. You may have, let's say, 3-dimensional phase space if you need q, p, and something else. Okay? So yeah. And so now this, so really, here I'm saying Nambu tensor is a P form, has nothing to do with that P or whatever. Yeah. Okay, so this is my Poisson bracket now. And of course, to specify the dynamics, now I don't need one Hamiltonian, but I need actually P minus one Hamiltonians. Okay, so then the dynamics, you need p minus 1 Hamiltonians, h1, h p minus 1, and then you define a time evolution as df over dt, which is just a Poisson bracket, h1, h p minus 1. Okay? So now your time evolution is a little bit more complicated, but maybe that's the case, right? So far we are finding probably not. That's really all you need is one Hamiltonian for most of the systems, and it's enough to describe dynamics. But this allows for more general possibility. So as an example, okay. So now there is not very many applications of this thing. So what you can show is that this is all very consistent if you define that D on eta nicely, and you have things like Liouville theorem. You have things like, well, everything S in Hamiltonian mechanics. There is no problem whatsoever with the formulation. Mathematically, it's perfectly well defined. The only thing is that so far there is no physical applications really of this thing. So one example of what this D may look like. So if you have, let's say, 3D space, and maybe I have, you know, these are x and p and r. These are my three variables I need to describe my system. This is the phase space. It's not configuration space. Okay, and you can choose eta to be epsilon, the Levi-Civita tensor. Tensor. It's probably no. Is there this thing? Probably not. It's the same guy. So then this is your Poisson bracket that is simply given by epsilon ijk dif dj g dk h. And so this is an example of a Poisson bracket which has three entries and satisfy all these nice things. So now I said there are no really physical applications. It's not true. There are applications to superintegrable systems. So for example, you can recast the Kepler motion into this language. You can find more Hamiltonians. These Hamiltonians are basically the conserved quantities. So you take the Hamiltonian as usual, and then you take, let's say, A as another Hamiltonian, or a square as another Hamiltonian, and you can write it in this formulation. So superintegrable systems can be recasted in Nambu mechanics, but it's sort of an artificial example, right? So you know that the Hamiltonian description exists, and then you are just recasting in a new description. That's not very good. But maybe there are systems which can be only described in this way, but not in Hamiltonian way. So that's a question for you. And you can talk about this with Georg Mimich, who actually published some papers on number mechanics. And he is one of your external examiners. So when he is here, you know, examining you from your essay, then you can talk about number mechanics to him. Okay. Questions to this? And I put a challenge in the lecture notes for you, so if you can solve that challenge, I'll be very happy. I don't know the answer. So if you solve the challenge, please speak to me, and I'll be happy if you have something. Okay, I'll not give you 10 minutes, that's too many.
Questions?
All right, so now I did this nice formulation of Hamiltonian mechanics, but I didn't allow for the Hamiltonians to depend on time. Okay, so that's something I am actually owing you. But to have this property that Hamiltonian or other functions can explicitly depend on time, you actually cannot describe this in terms of the symplectic geometry. But you have to go to its a sister, which is called contact geometry. Okay, so it's very, very similar to symplectic geometry, but it's basically an odd dimensional version of symplectic geometry. You have 2n plus 1 dimensional phase space now. Okay, so part D is the contact geometry, but don't worry, everything you have learned in the symplectic geometry, you basically can use here as well. It's just slightly different description. Basically adding one more dimension to your phase space. Okay, so now before I do anything, let me just define what you mean now by a two-form which is non-degenerate in terms of this thing. So you say a vector field X for which if you have a two-form omega x and y is equal to 0 for all y, so you feed your two-form two vector fields. If there exists such a vector x, that this is true for all y, you call x is a null vector of two-form omega. Okay, so that's definition number one. So given a two-form omega, you call such a vector x, which gives you this, for all y, a null vector. Okay. Of course, this vector may not exist, but it may as well. Okay, so now another definition is you use this vector x to classify what omega is. So you say that a two-form omega is non-singular if the vector space generated by these null vectors x has the minimal dimension possible. Okay. If and only if the vector space spanned by the corresponding null vectors has minimal possible dimension.
So basically, you have two possibilities. Either you have dimension zero or you have dimension one. And so dimension zero, and that happens in even dimensional spaces, even dimensions. So M has two N. So now it was exactly the case of symplectic geometry, which we studied before. So we had a 2n dimensional space, and our omega was completely non-degenerate, meaning that in the canonical frame, it has zeros on the diagonal, but plus minus ones everywhere else. And as a matrix, the determinant of this thing was non-zero. And yeah, as a matrix, it was non-degenerate thing. So this is that case. Or if you have all dimensions, then actually you can have one-dimensional space of these null vectors x. So in other words, well, you will see that in a minute. So in all dimensions, there's this extra dimension, and it may happen that omega is degenerate in that extra dimension. But if you say that it's only in that extra dimension, then your two form is degenerate, but you still say it's non-singular. Okay, that's just a definition, what you mean by non-singular. Okay, final definition. Final definition is that you say when omega is closed, and non-singular, then you call the pair M. Now I specified 2n plus 1 dimensions. I'm in this on-dimensional case. And omega is called a contact manifold. Contact manifold. So in the same way as symplectic manifold, symplectic geometry is a 2n dimensional space equipped with non-degenerate omega, you say that the contact manifold is a 2n plus dimensional space with non-singular omega. Okay, so exactly the same thing, right? Questions? Yeah.
So is this the same as like choosing some hyperplane in each of your tangent spaces along with like some integrability condition or something?
What do you mean? There's no integrability conditions at this point.
So if you choose like any such hyperplane, you could probably always find some two form that will like cut that out. They may not be closed.
Okay, very good. So if I just require that omega is non-singular, there's no integrability condition whatsoever, right? So it's just, you know, basically you can show that, you know, in two n plus one dimensions, you cannot have the non-degenerate omega. You can have non-singular one, which basically have like one zero eigenvalue, but all the other ones are non-trivial. So now I require that d omega is also equal to zero, which, I don't know if that is really an integrability condition, maybe it is. I don't know, it's a good question. All right, so let me make a few remarks. So it's obvious that this is an odd-dimensional version of symplectic geometry. Okay. So because omega is closed, it can be generated locally from a one form, and this one form is called contact one form. So omega generated by, and this is called contact one form. Theta, so that omega is d of theta, right? Okay, so now, in some sense, you start with your contact one from theta, you form out of it your omega, and then this omega uniquely determines this vector field x, which is the corresponding null vector field, which is the only direction in which the omega has this zero eigenvalue. Okay, so, and generated by contact one form theta, omega equals to d over d theta, and determines a unique, and this direction is the null direction, but sometimes this null direction is also called vortex direction. Vortex direction, I don't know why. Vortex direction x, which is given by x hook on omega, the scale product between x and omega equals to zero. So you may think about it as an eigenvalue problem. You have omega is a matrix, x is the corresponding eigenvector, and I'm saying that the corresponding eigenvalue is equal to zero. Okay, so it's this x is really picking that special direction where my omega is degenerate. Okay, and so we have null direction, sometimes called vortex direction, but in a special context of special manifolds, special Riemannian manifolds, this is called Riebe vector as well. So especially, so all these things are the same thing. Riebe vector is this vortex direction x, which is normalized. Vortex direction x, such that if you take theta, which is a one form, you eat x, you get one. So it's a normalized special direction x, and you call it Riebe vector, and then that's something mathematicians use.
Is it connected to the Killing vector?
Not necessarily. It could be, but not necessarily here. It definitely leaves, well, yeah, omega is okay. Omega is okay. So for Killing vector, you would need also some, well, for omega is okay, yeah. Okay, so it's Riebe vector here. So why don't we stop here?